I do believe that painting is the most magical of the mediums because it transcends its physical reality. You have colored dirt, and you dip this stick with hairs glued on the end of it and rub it around in that colored dirt and smear it on some cloth that's wrapped around some wooden sticks. It makes space where there was no space, and it can punch a hole in the wall. A painting can make you cry, and you're just looking at colored dirt smeared on a flat surface.
It's Chuck Close, a painter famous for his huge canvases and his uncanny ability to portray his subjects with almost photographic realism. What may be most remarkable is that Close ever became a portrait painter because he has a neurological condition that prevents him from recognizing people's faces. He's also partially paralyzed, having suffered a spinal artery collapse in 1988. Today, Chuck Close is in his early 70s, still painting, with brushes strapped to his hand, and now the subject of a biography by his friend Christopher Finch. Close and Finch recently sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about Close's painting career, going back to his grad school days in the mid-60s, when the talk among art critics was that painting was dead. Chuck Close.
If you were stupid enough to be a painter, you wouldn't want to be a figurative painter, and then the stupidest thing of all to do would be to do portraits. Clement Greenberg, the dominant critic at the time, said, there's only one thing that can't be done anymore, and that's paint a portrait. And I thought, oh, well, if Clement Greenberg says you can't make one, then that looks like a pretty good idea to me, and I'm not going to have a lot of competition. I'll have the whole area to myself. And it definitely did appeal to me to do something which was sort of perverse. It was very surprising, don't you think, Chris?
Well, it certainly surprised me when I walked into your studio that first visit, because there was big self-portrait, the one that's now in the Walker. Is it 21 or 28 foot nude?
22.
Boy, did those surprise me. This was not what I was expecting to see. And I think it surprised the entire art world. There were people who were... Those paintings at the time seemed almost transgressive, as though Chuck had done something terrible.
And to some degree, I think they still do look transgressive. And yet, if we talk about representational art and painting the human body, the human face, that's as old as it gets in painting, isn't it?
Well, it is, but the scale was different. Nobody had really painted anything that large to be seen from close to.
The thing that I think made it perhaps so shocking was that you weren't sure whether they were photographs, whether they were handmade, so you had to go up and look at them. And it was a warts and all view. I mean, you don't see big images of movie stars or something that haven't been, you know, corrected within an inch of their lives and all the zits and crow's feet and everything erased.
Hmm. So size has always mattered to you. The fact that you're painting on such an enormous scale, is it just because, I don't know, it hits you over the head?
I always said the bigger they are, the longer they take to walk by, and therefore the harder they are to ignore. But I always like extremes, make little teeny things or really big. You know, the thing that I hated was practicality. You know, when I was teaching in the university, everyone made art. We called it station wagon art. They didn't make anything too big because it wouldn't fit in their station wagon. That kind of practicality begins to make for a numbing sameness in all the work. And really, scale is a lot about the way we experience something. If we can't see it readily as a whole, you're forced to scan it and your eyes dart across it and move around it. You know, I wanted to knock people's socks off. I didn't care whether they loved them or they hated them, but I didn't want them to leave the exhibition and say, oh, was there a Chuck Close in that show? You're damn well going to know there was one there, and then you can decide whether you like it or not.
Hmm. Now, you have a really interesting way of creating a painting, and very elaborate from what I've read. Almost all of your work uses a grid as the underlying structure as you're creating the image. You start by taking a photograph, and then you turn that photograph into a painting. Can you explain this process?
Yeah, but first, maybe why the photograph? And that comes from the fact that my learning disabilities, which are ordinarily considered to be problems just to be overcome, really drove me to do what I'm doing today. And one of them is face blindness, or as Chris will tell you,
prosopagnosia,
which is an inability to recognize faces.
This is actually a neurological condition you have. You cannot recognize faces, which is fascinating when you think that what you do is you paint human faces.
But when I flatten them out, I have near photographic memory for anything that's flat. So it makes perfect sense that I work from a flat subject, that is a photograph, rather than painting from a live human being.
Well, can you explain how you use your system of grids? I mean, how you work on a tiny little piece of the painting and then you move on to the next piece. How do you go about doing that?
Well, another part of my learned disability is that I'm overwhelmed by the whole, so breaking it down into lots of little pieces. So I'm so plagued with indecision, I can't order in a restaurant. And then I always wish I had ordered what you ordered. But when I break things down into small enough bite-sized chunks, I'm able to make a decision. So once I've got it broken down in a grid, I have a choice as to what systems I'm going to use. Now, I might ink up my fingers and put fingerprints on those grids, or I might take wet pulp and push that into the squares, or do diagonal lines, or scribble in each square, or paint five or six or seven colors as sort of donut shapes or lozenge shapes or hot dog shapes. I know where I'm going. I don't know how I'm going to go there.
But the thing that's so remarkable is that the painting is totally different if you're way up close. I mean, you see those painterly techniques you've been talking about. You're playing with color and light. And then when you step way back, it looks almost like a photograph. I mean, this incredible realism. I mean, it's somehow having both those qualities within the same image is remarkable.
You know, actually, I feel that most great art, let's say since the beginning of the 20th century, has played with that tension between figuration and non-figuration. I mean, look at a Cubist painting, it can be almost abstract, and yet you see there's a violin or a guitar and the front page of Le Monde. Chuck's just found a new way of doing it.
I can only imagine that this whole process must be incredibly time-consuming, especially if you're creating a canvas that's 9 feet high or something like that. How long does it take you to complete one painting?
Well, it depends upon the kind of painting. There were paintings that took more than a year to make a single painting. There were several of those that took 12 or 14 months. The ones that I'm doing now take 3 or 4 months. So I do about 3 paintings a year.
Now, much has been made of what happened to you in 1988 when you were 48 years old. You suffered a spinal artery collapse, which left you paralyzed from the neck down. Later, you were able to regain some movement, which allowed you to continue painting. When you look back on your career, when you look back on your life, do you tend to draw a line between before 1988 and after?
To a certain extent, but frankly, I really can hardly remember life before the event, as I call it. And sometimes when I roll by a mirror, I'm shocked to see that I'm in a wheelchair, because I sit and look out at a world that's essentially unchanged. When people look at me, they see me in a wheelchair, and they see somebody who's disabled. But that's not really how I see myself. You know, it's a good thing I wasn't a violinist or a pianist, because I would not have been able to get back to work. I thought that the two great fears of the artist were losing your eyesight and losing your hands, and I thought they were equally devastating. What I found out was losing the use of your hands is not nearly the obstacle to overcome, clearly, the blindness would be, and that once I figured out how to strap brushes to my hands and get back to work, I don't think the work changed a great deal.
Even though I'm assuming your technique must be very different now that, I mean, you have the brush strapped to your hand. I'm guessing you don't have the same fine motor control that you once had.
Well, I can't draw easily because drawing requires wrist and finger movement. I don't have wrist and finger movement, but you do paint with pretty much your whole arm.
There were things you had to learn to get used to, like you loved to work with filbert brushes before, and then you weren't able to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't twist the brush.
Yeah. But there was a point in the hospital early on when Chuck didn't know if he ever would have the use of his hands back, when he said one day, "I'm going to spit the paint onto the canvas if necessary." And he was deadly serious about that.
I assume this must have been terrifying when this first happened. I mean, wondering whether you really could paint again.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, if you ever been in a really bad car crash and time slows down and your car is spinning around and you're not sure whether you're going to, you know, careen into the oncoming truck in the other lane, there's something rather, I don't know, almost calm about what's happening. And the experience was a lot less exciting or devastating or whatever than I thought. I just lay there. I was zonked on steroids and hallucinating and all of that. But I spent 8 months in the hospital. I remember thinking at the time, well, now what am I going to do? I'll have to make work of a much more conceptual nature. I'll have other people execute it. There are so many artists today who don't make their own work. I mean, Damien Hirst or...
Jeff Koons and a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, and my great good friend Saul LeWitt, who had other people execute most of his work. And they still managed to have really a signature style. It worked, looked like theirs. So I was prepared to do that. I would have greatly missed the physicality of pushing paint around.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you describe this as essentially a problem that you then had to deal with. You're suggesting that limitations throughout your life have been very important to you as an artist. I mean, in some ways, you've thrived on overcoming limitations or working with limitations.
Well, limitations, you're not going to do this anymore, you're not going to do that anymore. And every time you decide not to do something, that focuses your attention on what is left and what you can do. And it's a way to move forward. It's a way to keep from having an artist block. I think that in general in society, we're way too involved in problem solving. Problem creation is a much more interesting thing to spend your energy on. If you can ask yourself an interesting enough question, no one else's answers will fit. And you'll have to be a different artist than you were the last time. And you'll have to come up with a personal and idiosyncratic answer to this personal and idiosyncratic question that you've given yourself, and you're doing it without worrying about how other people are solving this problem because nobody else is working on it.
That's Chuck Close, along with his biographer, Christopher Finch, talking with Steve Paulson.